Hey, Rob Bradford here. You guys know I'm always up for a good MVP story, and one of the best stories is Wasabi Technology. Wasabi is the world's hottest cloud storage company, and it's become the go-to provider for professional and collegiate sports teams, including 20 Major League Baseball teams like the Red Sox and NHL teams like the Bruins and Vancouver Canucks. Even the Liverpool Football Club is getting in on the Wasabi action. So why is Wasabi the MVP? Well, Wasabi was purpose-built to free businesses from skyrocketing storage costs and unpredictable transaction fees that the Amazons of the world are charging. In fact, Wasabi is up to 80% less than those hyperscalers and doesn't charge a cent for businesses to access their data. From Wasabi's AI-enabled intelligent media storage, Wasabi Air, to the industry's only cloud storage service with triple protection against cyber criminals, data deletion, and ransomware, Wasabi's taking the lead in driving innovation in data storage and helping sports teams to unleash the power of their data. Wasabi, another Boston-based championship team.
Normally, if one of us is going to be gone on the show before the show podcast, we just like maneuver it in a way where it's like, hey, Sam's not with us for this segment, but he'll be back later on, blah, blah, blah. This week, I just forced Sam into doing a segment so I could be on the opening of the show before the show podcast. And then you're like, not going to hear me the rest of the way because I'm headed to Mexico City tomorrow and I'm pretty excited about it. Hi, Sam.
For a good reason. Yeah. Tyler, correct. I mean, yeah. You are going down there for a baseball related reason.
I am. Yeah. I'm not working it, but I'm going down for the Rockies Astros games for my money, maybe the most beautiful baseball stadium in the world. The home of the Diablos Rojos. Of the Mexican Baseball League, the Diablos Rojos del Mexico. And they play at Estadio Alfredo Harpelú, which is stunning. I mean, it's as cool of a ballpark as you will ever see in your life. But one of my wife's best friends from college, her husband works for the Houston Astros. When MLB announced this series last year, they texted and were like, we're going to reserve some tickets for those games. You guys want to come? We're like, yes, absolutely. So we're going to go hang out in Mexico City for a few days. I already packed my Diablos Rojos hat. Very excited. So I'm leaving. Ordinarily, we record the podcast on Thursday. And today, it's Tuesday. I texted Sam yesterday. I was like, hey, I'm going to be out of the country. You want to just do this tomorrow? And Sam, being the consummate gentleman and professional that he is, was like, yeah, I can make that work.
Well, I know you wait. Something's gonna happen between today and Thursday. Ben and I, we should be clear here. Like Ben and I will chat later.
Yeah, right.
There will be like a normal show this week in many aspects. But yeah, I was gonna say like watch Jackson Holliday gets called up, but he's already up.
Already there.
Yeah.
You know, one of the guys who we're going to talk about on this week's episode of the show before the show, you might be there soon. Maybe that's just wait until next week. Things will be somewhat normal-ish next week. Just wait until next week.
I'll put in some text to the Pirates and the Indianapolis Indians of like,
hold this guy back just for one more turn through the rotation. Yeah. So we can talk about it in adequate timing on the podcast. With that, we welcome you into the official podcast of Minor League Baseball. My name is Tyler Mon. Sam Dykstra is in New York City. Benjamin Hill will be along shortly, as will Josh Jackson a little while later for Ghosts of the Minors. We have a special hello that we have to get out on this week's episode of the show before the show. And that is to one Raymond Morris, who emailed in to say that he tuned into his first ever episode of the Show Before the Show podcast, an episode 452. Now, if you were with us last week, Cheryl Soborowski, who also tuned in for the very first time in episode 452, we gave her a shout out. So I felt like, all right, we got to give Raymond a shout out as well. His first ever episode of the podcast, he said, quote, I'm not sure I've ever felt so welcomed and special listening to a podcast introduction, and now I'm scared the next won't be as special. Well, this is the peak. Now that we're giving you like a full-on shout out, it's all downhill from here. I'm sorry. Very sorry, Raymond. It doesn't get any better from this.
But listen, if you are listening to this for the first time yourself and you would like to reach your own peak in podcasting, please reach out to us at podcast at MILB.com. We can keep this train moving. Yeah, like, I would love to do that. Yeah, keep shouting out new listeners every week. We'll do it. We're not above it.
We keep threatening that we're going to start a Patreon. So soon we're just going to need to do that. And then people who contribute, we'll give them like that. Ah, and here's to Mark B in, you know, Scanny Atlas, New York. And
our AAA level subscribers, our AA level subscribers. It's almost like we have a tiered system built in for this very thing.
This is a good idea, actually. I'm getting more and more interested in it by the day. Well, we welcome you to this week's episode of the show before the show, and we've got kind of a bookend segment to kick off this week's episode, talking about the thing that we were previewing in last week's episode, and that was Sam's journey to Indianapolis to watch the top pitching prospect in baseball, Paul Skeens, just go out and dazzle once more for the Pittsburgh Pirates, AAA affiliate in Indianapolis, with Sam Dykstra in attendance, which makes people the most nervous that they've ever been. 3 1/3, one hit, no runs, 2 walks, 8 strikeouts. You got a chance to talk to Paul Skeens. We're going to hear that here in a little bit. But give us your biggest takeaways from getting a chance to watch him in person in a competitive start, not a spring training situation. It's not, you know, for some top prospects, a fall league situation or that sort of thing. An in-game regular season performance in which he was dominant.
Yeah, I mean, he really was dominant. I mean, you guys will hear this coming up in the interview, but you know, he's just has a mastery of his stuff, has an understanding of his stuff, an ability to change his stuff kind of on the fly, which makes him really special. Listen, not everybody's going to be able to touch 102 like he can. In that start, he touched 102, striking out Tony Kemp, who is, you know, a veteran major leaguer at this point. He's in Minnesota to provide some infield depth, got some at-bats earlier in the year with Baltimore. Guy's been around. He's seen a ton of really good pitching in the major leagues. Paul Skeens blowing 102.1 past him like it's no big deal. He looked like a veteran arm. He looked like a guy who's supremely confident. You mentioned those 8 strikeouts in 3 1/3 innings. Talking to him after Thursday, and this won't be in the interview because that was for a game story, but you hear him talk about his own frustration with the way the Pirates are handling him right now. And I don't think the Pirates are upset by that by any means. Obviously, they're slow playing him. He hasn't gone above 3 1/3 innings yet in any start, but they're doing that to save, you know, some innings for potentially September, potentially October. You look at the start the Pirates have had. They've got a really good rookie pitcher right now in Jared Jones, who, as you and I are talking, Tyler, he just dominated the Brewers the other night. Can you imagine a rotation that's trying to compete in the NL Central, led by Skeens, led by Jones, and those guys are able to pitch deep into the season? That's why they're doing this. On the other hand, Paul Skeens, you know, that's very nice of you to say. People get very nervous if I'm in attendance. That's not at all true. But this is a guy who's pitching.
I got to make sure I don't screw up in front of Sam.
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to say, well, I know, but you're built differently than Paul Skeens, who a year ago was pitching in the SEC for an eventual national champion. This guy has pitched in Omaha. He's pitched on the biggest stage of college baseball possible and made it look like no big deal. And he's ready to go 6 innings right now. Like, he is that competitive. He said, you know, it's frustrating that I'm being taken out. I was mad when the manager came out and took me out after 65 pitches. It's over his head. It's over my head. I understand that, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to be frustrated. And the Pirates want a guy who wants the ball. That's just the case of the matter. Like, they want a guy who wants to be on the mound as much as he can, and they're saving him now for later. But to see those competitive juices flowing, it's really interesting to me. Talking to him about his arsenal for a story that is on both MLB.com and MILB.com. Obviously, you know, the triple digit heat is going to be incredibly good. He's thrown more 100 plus mile an hour fastballs than anybody else in AAA, and he's basically lapping the field when it comes to that. There are some evaluators who think his slider is just as good. And in fact, it's been even better at getting swing and miss early on. The thing that stood out to me is that he will throw some sliders that look like sweepers. They've got like 16 inches of sweep across the zone. And then he'll throw some sliders that almost look like cutters. They're like 1 or 2 inches of horizontal movement, or even going arm side instead of glove side. And I asked him about that because you know, you could look at it and say, like, maybe these are two different pitches. Maybe he is throwing a sweeper and maybe he's throwing a cutter. But no, it's all thrown with a slider. He's just manipulating the arm action or whatever. He said it's all based off feel. He knows when he can throw the longer one, when he can throw the shorter one. You know, talking to his catcher, he was like, sometimes I don't know which one is coming. I can anticipate, but I have to react sometimes. And that's kind of incredible to me because they're always calling slider. But like, if it's going to move 16 inches, you got to be able to see it. It's just the way it works with Paul Skeens that he has those multiple options. And then the one that sticks out most to me, and I'm really excited to hear people hear him talk about it specifically, is his splinker, which we touched on a little bit last week. It's a mid-90s pitch. It moves like a sinker. He thinks of it as a sinker, which is what he'll say here. But it's got a low spin rate like a splitter. He actually kind of throws it with a little bit of a split grip, and it's something he found by accident, which is what he'll say, when he was just fooling around trying to add the sinker back, because he knew, listen, I don't need a sinker in college. 100 miles an hour, this is going to work. I'm going to get college guys out, no problem. Pro bats, they're going to be able to catch up to that a little bit better. So I need a pitch with more movement, something that can move arm side like a sinker can. So he started playing around with it between the College World Series and the draft. All of a sudden his finger kind of slipped, and then it did something funky with killing spin and was still diving like a splitter would, but the velo is there. It's like Yoan DeRyan of the Minnesota Twins. He has a splinker, which is thrown, I think, about 3 miles an hour faster than what Skeens does, but it's very unique in the way it works. So the fact that he has another option like that is kind of incredible. And if you think like, oh, maybe that's his changeup. No, he has an actual changeup that works really well as well. And then he has a curveball on top of that, which is just a more vertical breaking pitch on top of the slider. So he's coming at you with five different pitches. You think back to the days of fireballers and you just be like, well, that's good enough. Just keep throwing 102. Some guys will catch it, some guys won't, but just lean on the old heater. He doesn't do that. He's got he'll do that the first time through the lineup. And that's what I'm really interested to see what happens as he pitches more and more deeper into games. And he talked about this as well. Like, he needs to know what it's like to face a pro lineup second time through, third time through. I think that third time through situation is going to come by the time he's in the majors. I think they're waiting for him to throw five innings. And I was talking to Jonathan Mayo about this earlier. He does our Pirates list. I think the Pirates are a little worried that he's striking out so many guys, he's running up his pitch count. He's not trying to do that. He's trying to get guys out, but they're swinging and missing so much that they're adding pitches to his pitch count. And that's why he's being taken out at 3 1/3. It's not, we're only going to let you get one out in the fourth. It's 65 pitches. This is how deep you got. So I think they want him to get five innings before he gets the call. He's getting there. Maybe it would be best for everybody if you got a few early swings and weak contact instead of working these 1-2, 2-2 counts, but it's really mastery of the stuff. It's really special stuff to begin with. He's big and tall at 6'6". It's really fun to see it in person. And when he shows up in the majors, it's going to take a lot of people by storm. There's a lot of hype behind this guy, number one overall pick, like I said, national champion, a lot to him, but the stuff, seeing it in person and having it match the reports that we already have, and seeing guys like Max Kepler was rehabbing for St. Paul in that same game. Matt Wallner had just been sent down. All of these guys were struggling against Skeens. So Pittsburgh's in for a real treat when he does get the call.
His four starts so far, pitch totals of 46, 44, 55, and 65. Through three innings, 3 1/3, and 3 1/3. One of the things that still always and forever is going to be incredible to me about Paul Skeens is that he started his college career at the Air Force Academy and had to transfer after 2 years. If you leave after your second year, you can still move out, go to a different school, play, get drafted, all of that. If you commit beyond your second year, as I understand it, then you're locked into the service that comes behind that with your military career and all that. But it's not often that we see eventual first rounders, much less 1-1 picks, start off at a service academy. And that's pretty amazing stuff, and pretty amazing stuff for the Air Force Academy itself to have landed a talent like that. I knew the pitching coach there when Paul Skeens started, who's now at Boston College, Ryan Forrest. And I mean, they knew immediately what kind of talent this guy was. And to see what Paul Skeens has turned himself into is a pretty awesome story beyond just, oh, this is an LSU guy who is a stud. His baseball road has already been so interesting to this point, and we're just at the start of the prologue, really. I'm not even sure this is chapter one.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you touched on the Air Force thing there, Tyler, because that's something we talk about in this interview. The bulk of the interview was about his individual pitches, but I find that similarly really interesting. The fact that he started at the Air Force Academy, because not only was he there, you know, potentially just to become an airman, but he was a catcher for his first 2 years. And that really informs who he is as a pitcher. I mean, I was talking to him on Thursday, the day before this interview, about, you know, this is his first day pitching in the fully ABS system. His first three starts were under the challenge system. So at least there were still balls and strikes being called by a human umpire, and then you could challenge it. This was fully ABS. And I asked him, how do you feel about pitching it under this system? And he's like, I don't like it. I'm a former catcher. I love framing, and I don't want to be credited with a strike if I miss my spot either. Like if my catcher is on the outside of the zone and I'm trying to throw it to the outside of the zone and I move it inside, ABS is going to call that a strike, but right. I don't want to be rewarded for that. Which, for him to put that on the record and say it that way, instead of it being amazing. Like, oh, you know, the zone's off. And it's like, no, I want my catcher to be rewarded for his framing. I want framing to be part of the game. Was really interesting. And we get into that too, of like, you're a former catcher. How does that inform who you are as a pitcher?
Right.
You've been on the other side of this. Now, what is it like? So there are some interesting details on that. And one other thing I want to touch on in terms of him being, you know, having an Air Force background, Air Force Academy background. It's a small thing, but it really stood out to me is that the way he stands at attention during the national anthem, it's like it was burned into him. I mean, you know how it goes. I'm not saying anybody's being disrespectful. I'm not playing it that way whatsoever. But
it's just different.
It's just different.
Yeah.
And, you know, guys are swaying or like half listening, or that's the way it goes. You do this every day as your job. Like, you're going to hear a lot of national anthems midweek. It might not be that important. He is all 6'6" of them, straight up in the air, hand at his side, like hat over the heart. And then, so there's that part of it that speaks to character in some way. And then there were these clips that went viral, and I took a picture of it. I should have taken a video, apparently, but he was signing autographs after his start on Thursday. The line went up the row around the concourse, and he stayed until every person got an autograph.
So cool.
It was the first thing he did. Like, the game ended, gave everybody high fives, Indians win, really cool, whatever. And I'm like kind of waiting for him to come out of the dugout, and I'll grab him quick for my interview. He went the other way, right to where the queue was already forming, because it was forming in the ninth inning. Like, people were ready for him to sign out. He's taking pictures with everybody, selfies for whoever wants it. There's a security guard there in case it. And he thanked the security guard afterwards. Like, he gets it. Paul That's Skeens so gets cool. it. And I don't know how much of that is the discipline that comes from an academy background and how much of that is just who he is to begin with. I mean, you have to be a certain type of person willing to go to the academy in the first place.
Right.
So that it's just those little details you pick up from actually seeing guy. Like, I could have told you he hit 102 if I was sitting at home. Right. Like, that's
right.
We have Statcast data. That's a thing you can see. I can tell you how many swings and misses, but to get that level of character. And I think that comes through in this interview as well, in which he's very honest and forthcoming about the stuff he cares about and the stuff he doesn't care about in terms of his pitches. So it was a really, really enjoyable visit to Indianapolis last week.
Very selfishly, I want this for Pirates fans so badly. I spent 1 year working in the Pirates organization. Those years, you know, with the Pirates hosting the wild card game, the playoff atmospheres at PNC Park, the blackouts with the crowd chanting at Johnny Cueto and him dropping the ball, all that type of stuff. Pirates fans are such good baseball fans. They deserve something to be this excited about. And Paul Skeens can be that guy. They're 12-11 to start this season. You know, last year, obviously, Pittsburgh blew up right out of the gate. They won 20 games in April. People thought, man, where's this Pirates team coming from? It's not a super strong division. Are they going to hang in? They didn't, obviously, over the course of the 2023 season. They ended up fading, and they finished that season 76-86. But if you can take that next step forward and you can be in the hunt in the National League Central, where I don't think anybody is really going to blow the doors off. Obviously, the Brewers, a really good start to the season, won the division last year. But if you can hang in and then all of a sudden you're adding a bona fide ace at the top of your rotation, I'm not saying that the Pirates are making the playoffs this year, but the Pirates are trending up, and that's a very cool thing for Pirates fans. Also, before we get to this interview, I just want to point out some numbers really quick. Paul Skenes, freshman year at Air Force, 18 appearances, 11 saves, 2.70 ERA, 30 strikeouts in 20 innings pitched against 9 walks. And a whip of 1.088. Sophomore year at Air Force, gets into the starting rotation, 10-3 record, 2.73 ERA, struck out 96 against 30 walks and 85 2/3. While he was doing all of that, first season in college baseball in 48 games, he slashed 410, 486, 697 with 11 homers and 43 RBIs for an 1183 OPS. And in his sophomore year, 52 games, 314, 412, 634, 13 homers that year, and 38 runs batted in. Like, this dude does everything. He could probably dunk from a standstill under the rim. He could probably, he'll shoot 12 under par. Like, he's just one of those. I'm sure he's bowled multiple 300 games. How do these people exist? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I mean, yeah, he's definitely blessed with all of that. And, it's fascinating to see what he could have been as a hitter.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the DH should be abolished in the NL, but I would just like to see what a round of BP would look like from Paul Skenes. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
Ohtani can do it. He can do it. He can swing it.
Sure.
He can swing it as a DH. I'm not sure it'd be, MVP level, but it'd be pretty cool to see.
Yeah. What Ohtani does is incredibly hard. I saw somebody trying to say, is Nolan McLean of the New York Mets going to be the next Shohei Ohtani, who's a guy at high A? Really good slider, really good fastball. Is a pretty good hitter, can hit for power, but like, we need to stop this.
Next Shohei Ohtani, he's the first since Babe Ruth. I think it's going to take a little bit longer than like, during his career, we had the next Shohei Ohtani. I don't know.
And I just before we start the interview, Tyler, I just want to go back to what you were saying of like adding Skenes, a bona fide ace. Jared Jones, his numbers,
right?
I know we're a minor league podcast, so like, we're focusing on Skenes here. He's the rookie, he could be a rookie of the year favorite. If this keeps up for another month, he's got a 2.79 ERA, 39 strikeouts, only 4 walks in 29 innings. Like, he would be the story in Pittsburgh for anybody else. And it's like, oh yeah, we have the number 1 overall pick coming.
Right.
This is how, I don't want to say dynasties are built, but like, the Orioles were like this for a long time with the hitters.
Right.
And now Heston Kerstad's up as of today, Jackson Holliday's up, been a slow start, but like, all those guys are starting to come around. For the Pirates, it's the arms that are coming around.
Yeah.
Bubba Chandler's not going to be very far off either. And like, they're going to really have a strong homegrown rotation here by 2025, if not midway through 2024.
Also, Jared Jones, I mean, not exactly a, I don't want to say unheralded, certainly, but I would not say that he came out with nearly the same sort of hype as somebody, like Paul Skenes. He was ranked 55th. In the MLB pipeline prospect rankings going into that draft. His draft year was 2020, so it was that weird year he was taken in the second round of 5 rounds that year, that shortened draft. Out of high school, he's, still just 23 years old, not even 23. He's not going to be 23 until August. So the Pirates have some good pieces, and it's an exciting time. So tee it up with maybe the most exciting piece for the Pittsburgh Pirates, Sam.
Yeah, so this interview, like we've said, it's going to span a lot about his individual pitches, his pitch mix, how he's able to throw his fastball, his slider, that splinker, the curveball, and changeup. And I just want to tee up this first part of the interview because it's picking up from what I was talking about earlier with ABS. I think my first question is, as we were talking about yesterday, that's me asking him about dealing with ABS and him talking about his background as a catcher. So that's the context you need to begin this conversation. And from there, we hit on numerous topics, from how he's able to throw 100+ miles an hour to why he moves on the mound like he does, to why he manipulates his slider and what that looks like. So it's a pretty wide ranging conversation. So here's me chatting with number one pitching prospect, Paul Skenes.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You were talking about last night when we were talking about ABS and your history as a catcher. How do you feel like that's helped you in terms of determining pitch sequencing and usage?
A ton. And I think part of it is I just have a mind for getting hitters out beating pitchers. That's why I'm not hitting anymore. So.
Right.
But yeah, I was you know, lucky enough to call my own game when I was at Air Force. So we were, you know, digesting scouting reports and that kind of thing. And then, you know, obviously catering it to who's pitching, which has been cool. And now I'm kind of on the other side of that more. So, I mean, I was pitching the whole time when I was at Air Force and right. LSU, obviously. But now I'm, you know, completely on the other side. And so, yeah, I was able to learn a lot through catching about how to get hitters out.
In that calling game aspect, was that something they gave you immediately, or is that something they had to warm up to you?
Yeah, no, well, you got to, I mean, everyone does it kind of throughout the fall. And then, you know, I earned it, basically. And, you know, it's our coaches would like to say that it's a leadership opportunity, you know, which is, you know, what they're doing more so than making baseball players. They're developing leaders, so. Working with pitchers, figuring out, you know, a plan and that kind of thing. That's all leadership. So that was kind of the mindset of it. Also to, you know, that was their philosophy in terms of getting hitters out too. But as soon as I started catching there, I pretty much had free reign over that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how's your approach changed as a pitcher from high school to the Air Force to LSU to even now?
It's just gotten more self-awareness for sure. Obviously, as I've gotten better, my plan has had to change. And throughout that, I'm just trying, everything I'm shooting for is just self-awareness in terms of how my stuff is going to play to get hitters out. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, not just in terms of pitch sequencing and that kind of thing, but like my body, you know, strength conditioning, like everything is just self-awareness, in my opinion. So that's what I'm shooting for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when did that moment of self-awareness kick in to where you are now, where it's the fastball that's playing, it's the slider, you know?
I don't know. And I don't know if it, because I think it's more of an evolving thing rather than just, you know, wake up one day and I have it figured out. Because, you know, hopefully in 2 weeks I'm going to be better than I am today. And, you know, today I feel like I'm better than I was 2 weeks ago too. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and so as I go throughout that, it's always evolving, it's always changing, and I think just being aware of that is the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of that evolution, how do you feel like you're different as a pitcher from the day you were drafted with the Pirates' guidance and coaching?
Self-awareness. I think just knowing how my stuff plays against big league hitter or against professional hitters is the biggest thing, because mm-hmm. The stuff hasn't changed a ton. The sinker's changed a little bit, but the stuff hasn't changed a whole lot, and it's just... I think just being able to command and attack the zone, like more so like just learning how to pitch rather than changing anything that I need to do. So
yeah, you mentioned the sinker. How has it changed, do you feel it?
So it was the cue that I didn't throw it a ton during the season last year in college, yeah. Just because, you know, on the self-awareness thing, it was going to get beat just because it was a bad speed pitch a little bit, like to go inside to righties with it, with metal bats, like it wasn't going to play, so. But I was getting it off my middle finger in college, and then I started playing around with it, kind of leading into the draft, right after the draft, when I was at home, and I was I just felt it off my index finger. So it is a different pitch than I was throwing it in college last year. So, but that was something that I started doing really when I got to pro ball, just because it just so happened that I figured it out between college and pro ball. It's not anything that, you know, not a magic switch that like flipped or anything like that. So, but yeah, I've just been, you know, ripping it out really.
Yeah. So is that just like a feel thing going from the middle finger to the index finger? I mean, did that happen by accident? How did that?
Yeah, it happened by accident, and then it became a conscious thing to, you know, get it off that finger. More so, and you know, you watch Edge video, like it still comes off the middle finger last, but the feel for me and the thought is to get it off the index finger. So that was something I felt, like I said, between the College World Series and the draft, and I just kept repping it out, and then you know, now I kind of know what I need to do to get the shape and command over it and when to throw it and that kind of thing. That's what I've been, you know, shooting to do.
Yeah, and speaking of thought process, you're calling it a sinker. Some people are calling it a splinker. What is your thought process, just sinker the entire time you're throwing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just tough to scout for a little bit, and I think that's why they started calling it a splinker a little bit, is because it's not like any other sinker, and it's not like a splitter, really. Like, it's a hybrid pitch. So, because it doesn't have true, you know, it doesn't have a true sinker profile. Like, they're calling it changeup they're tagging it as changeup on the system that we use, like that kind of thing. It's not a changeup.
Right.
There's obviously a velo difference, and then I have a true changeup too. But yeah, you call it whatever you want. I call it a sinker. It plays differently than any other sinker, and it plays differently than any other splitter. That's all I can.
Have you ever tried to come up with a special name for it?
I let other people.
Not the Skeens or something.
No, Henry started calling it the splinker.
Right, so right.
I'll let him do that.
Yeah, fair enough. And I was looking at the data last night on your sliders. You were talking too about manipulating. Sometimes it was like 3 inches of sweep. Sometimes it was 16. What goes into the thought process of how to manipulate it when you're going to the shorter slider versus the longer one?
Just feel a little bit the situation. I couldn't tell you exactly what it is, but or if there is there, because there's no like end all be all in situations where like, yeah, this guy's up this count, I'm always going to throw the short one, I'm always going to throw the big one. It's just a feel thing too. So, and just like my stuff play.
How are you? Is it in the grip? Is it in the way you're throwing it?
It's just feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I couldn't tell you exactly what it is. It's just feel. I just know what the short one feels like and what the big one feels like.
Mm-hmm. So is it, are you just looking based on results? Are you looking at like scouting reports on when to throw it? I know you're talking about feel a lot, but it, like, how much does prep go into whether you're going to start with the shorter one versus the longer one?
Kind of all of it. With scouting reports and that kind of thing, and then just how I feel.
Yeah.
I'm a super feel driven guy, so yeah, the situation, you know, just how my body feels, that kind of thing.
No, totally. And we were talking last night about your changeup. I noticed one thing is some of them were like the slowest changeups you've thrown so far. Was that killing even more speed on it? Was that a point of emphasis last night?
I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
To be honest, so okay. Yeah, I don't know.
All right, no, fair enough. And you're saying, you know, you've thrown it all since high school, basically. How has the pitch changed at all?
I don't think it has a ton. That's been a pitch that I've had. You know, because when I was, you know, 10 or 11 learning how to pitch, like it was fastball changeup. And so I developed a feel for it then. It's a different pitch now. But the grip that I have now, I started throwing when I was like sophomore or junior in high school or something like that. And I just kept it the same throughout that. And so it's just a total feel pitch. And I'm super confident with it because I didn't really have a slider my freshman or sophomore year at Air Force, and I was fastball changeup, you know, as a closer. And so that, you know, just relying on that, like, it's just something that, you know, I'm super confident with.
Yeah, and I saw some video of it. It looked like a Vulcan-style grip. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let the people, right. It's a changeup for me. Like, I don't know what... I'm just trying to feel about my middle finger off the seam, so that's all I really care about.
Yeah, when you were saying you were throwing that a lot, you know, you were fastball changeup to start. Was that somebody giving you guidance of, like, you're too young to throw a breaking ball, focus on these two?
Probably. But then I also, like, I'm so pronation biased, like, it was really tough for me to find a breaking ball until I started throwing hard, frankly. Like, my hands sped up, and that allowed me to start throwing a breaking ball that I throw now. Because I can get off my fingers the right way. So, but until then, it wasn't a consistent breaking ball. So even when I was old enough to throw a breaking ball, it was pretty much always fastball changeup and then try to figure out something that moves left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when do you feel like that really locked in, that like, oh, this slider is now my best, my second best pitch?
Probably last year at some point. But, yeah, I mean, I was fooling around with a lot of different breaking pitches before then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of which, you're throwing a curveball as well. How do you feel like those two differentiate, and how does that give you like a fourth weapon, basically?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a different shape. And I started throwing that during the season last year, like probably the fourth or fifth week of the season in college, and I don't think guys had it on their report because the first time it literally got touched was in the SEC tournament. I thought it was like a foul ball or something like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was always like a take pitch or a swing and miss pitch, and now it's a little bit different because they have it in the report, but yeah, it's just a different shape. It's more of a hum. versus more of a, you know, flat spin, and some guys see the curveball better, some guys see the slider better.
Yeah, and speaking of being a guy who's going off feel and going off reaction, what do you feel like is the silliest reaction you've seen to any of your pitches so far this season?
Just swords. those are just fun to watch.
Are you somebody who keeps track of the amount of swords you have as the season goes along?
Well.
Okay.
I'll let everybody else do that.
Yeah, but you just file it away for, like, that got the reaction I was looking for. Okay, fair enough. And how does your approach just kind of change when, like, last year you were going 120 pitches? Now they're probably going to pull you into 50, 60 like they have so far. Do you pitch any differently, throw harder when you know it's an abbreviated start? How do you approach that?
I think more so I'm just trying to figure out what I need to do to get professional hitters out efficiently, because that's always the goal. I just had a little bit longer leash in college just because I was throwing less frequently, and I could do it. You know, I showed that I could do it last year, so that's why they let me go so long. But that's obviously not going to be the case now. The difference, I think, is the hitters, is just trying to get them out as efficiently as possible. So, you know, some adjustments that I've made and I'm going to have to continue to make. So,
yeah, and one thing we haven't touched on yet is the fastball, because everybody knows about the fastball. But how would you describe what your power source is in getting to the point where you are throwing 101, 102?
Just being strong, moving efficiently. Like, and it's not a, it's not magic. It's just you gotta, like, it works for me. Other guys do it differently, but that's kind of my bread and butter, is just being strong and moving efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know you're not a huge guy who's looking at rise and stuff like that, but your rise being where it is, you're still pretty efficient with the fastball. What do you attribute that to? Is it just the velocity? Is it extension? How do you feel like you get the fastball to play out?
Yeah, I have no idea. And I don't, I laugh when people talk about, you know, extension, you know, induced vertical break and stuff like that, because it helps you quantify it a little bit, but quantify why a guy is good or why a guy is bad, maybe, but or why that pitch plays well or doesn't play well or something like that. But I think the eyes kind of are the biggest thing. That's kind of, I don't look at my shapes a ton unless I find something that is drastically wrong in how I'm moving with my body, and then I might look at the shapes for, because the body is going to affect how the ball comes out of the hand too. So I might look at the shapes there. I just laugh when people talk about, you know, because the plot is the end all be all. Like, I just laugh.
Yeah, no, totally, I get it. And, speaking of positioning and all that, I've noticed you move around the mound a little bit. Is that something that started last year?
Yeah, and that was another thing we started doing during the season last year. Basically, just thought I could do it, and, you know, with my angle of my arm being, you know, crossfire a little bit too, right. Like, just thought it would be funky and help me tunnel a little bit better against each side of the plate if I switch. So, played around with it, and that's kind of something that I continue to do.
Yeah, where were you positioned before, like when you were in Air Force?
I think when I was at Air Force, I think it was third base side, and then I think I switched to the first base side.
Okay.
At LSU, and then I started switching.
Okay. Yeah, and what do you feel like that does, especially against righties?
If going from the first base side against righties, like, it gives me more room to work with, for sure, in terms of arm side and glove side. Like, I can, I feel that it helps me, you know, tunnel breaking balls. Mm-hmm.
Do you even adjust that game to game, or is it always, like, in this one specific spot?
Yeah, I adjust, but, you know, that's another feel thing, too.
Right, yeah, totally. And just what is your approach to AAA in general? I mean, every game here is, in theory, a major league audition. I know they're building you up innings-wise and pitches-wise, but what is it to feel like to be one step away here?
Obviously, it's cool. You know, it's a dream come true to be a big leaguer in the first place, so just looking forward to that day. But just trying to get as much out of being here as possible. And just learn from every outing. And that's, you know, that's the goal, whether I'm in the big leagues or here, low A or college, like wherever. I want to learn as much from every outing as possible to get me to the point where I can, you know, pitch in the big leagues for a long time and be, you know, really good there. So that's the goal there, is just trying to keep my eyes on what I'm trying to do, you know, at the end of the day. and figure out what I need to do here to make that happen.
Yeah, and just going back to what you were saying about the fastball in terms of being big and strong, when did you hit your growth spurt?
It started my freshman, sophomore year of high school.
Okay.
And I probably grew like 4 or 5 inches throughout my sophomore year. Put on a bunch of weight that year too, and I put on a lot of weight since then also. So it's been a constant thing. It just grown in my body.
Yeah. Is that when you started to feel like you were blowing past guys as you were adding height and weight, or was that just what you were doing in middle school?
I mean, I started adding height and weight, and I still felt like I was behind guys. So, yeah, I don't know. Really growing in my body and figuring out how to move. I think that's the combination. And then what allows me to stay on the field and kind of do what I do is being strong and moving efficiently also.
Yeah, and just to end on this one, going back to what we were talking about before, being a catcher, but also just your start at Air Force. How much did getting 2 years in the academy and under, you know, learning leadership under that way, how did you feel like that's set you up for your career?
It's been huge. And I met some of the greatest people I've ever going to meet in my life when I was there too. And a lot of the lessons that I learned there, I might not even remember them, but I learned them, and I think they're part of me now. So just super grateful for that experience, because it taught me a lot about myself, taught me a lot about other people, and how to be, you know, part of a team, how to lead, how to follow, all that. Two tough years, but probably two of the best years of my life of being there.
All right, great. That's all I have. Thanks so much.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Our thanks again to Paul Skeens for that conversation that we had last week in Indianapolis. Just a quick update after my conversation with Tyler last segment. Paul Skeens started on Wednesday in Omaha for the Indians and gave up his first earned run of the season. Don't worry, it was still a really good outing for Paul Skeens. His numbers as they stand right now on Thursday, a 0.53 ERA. 34 strikeouts in 17 innings. He's only walked 5 batters, and he has a 0.88 whip. So Paul Skeens, even when he gives up a run, still has a really solid start, is still striking guys out left and right. He got up to 4 1/3 innings for the first time. He pitched into the 5th inning for the first time for Indianapolis. That's a pretty solid sign that he's closing in on major league readiness. I still expect him to get one more start, at least with Indianapolis, before Pittsburgh gets makes the call to bring him up to the show. But another promising step forward for Paul Skeens. So thanks again to him for that conversation. And speaking of great conversations, we now bring in Benjamin Hill. Ben, we're doing things a little out of sorts this week, but glad to have you on now, especially ahead of what's a big week for you next week. You are hitting the Dusty Trail, headed out west to California. What are you already looking forward to about that trip? I know we've talked about it a little bit on the show before, but now we're even closer to it. So what are you looking forward to about next week?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd say that every time I'm introduced, it should be prefaced in that way. You know, speaking of great conversations, because as soon as I come in, you know, greatness is imminent. So I appreciate you acknowledging that. And yeah, it is a kind of disjointed week. We're all over the place. Sam's working from home right now. And I always associate Sam when he's working from home. He sets up in his kitchen and you can always see aluminum foil. And for a while, he had 2 aluminum foils on top of his microwave. Now there's just 1. But when Sam is working from home, I just think the first image that comes to my mind is aluminum foil. And that's neither here nor there. What is here, and I will soon be there, is my trip. And that's really what you're asking me, not all this rambling nonsense. And yeah, I'm hitting the road next week, going to San Jose, see the San Jose Giants at, what is it called now, Excite Ballpark on May 2nd, Thursday, Beer Batter Thursday. Modesto Nuts, I believe that's still called John Thurman Field. Modesto Nuts on Friday, May 3rd. Stockton Ports Banner Island Ballpark on Saturday, May 4th. That will be, Star Wars night. May the 4th be with you. And Sacramento River Cats at Sutter, or is it Suter? Health Ballpark. There's so much to keep track of. I can't always pronounce everything right. It's a chronic problem. But that's where I'm going to be. May 2nd, San Jose. May 3rd, Modesto. May 4th, Stockton. And May 5th, Sacramento. Excited to be back on the road. You know, I've been doing this every season since 2010, with, of course, the exception of 2020. And it's where I get a lot of my material, and it's where, professionally, you know, I feel the most alive.
Yeah. And speaking of which, you know, one of the big plans for your trips are always the designated eaters. Are you good on designated eaters for California? Do you still need any for next week?
No, I'm set. I've got a person in every location. You know, I first announced my entire road trip itineraries in the newsletter a couple weeks back. And so I'm accepting designated eater, quote unquote, applications for everywhere I'm visiting this season. You know, that window is closed for that first trip, but there's still at least three more trips on the calendar in June, July, and August. So still accepting those applications for anywhere else I'll be during the season. And of course, we'll talk about those upcoming itineraries. I talk about them in my newsletter, the Ben's Biz Beat. So please subscribe to that. It's a little tedious to give the subscription link, but please Google it and the word subscribe, or email me benjamin.hill@mlb.com. And I will tell you anything you need to know. Always happy to answer people's questions. But got those designated eaters ready for this first trip. And looking forward to seeing everybody. I think I remember everyone's name, too, but we don't have to get into it. They will have their moment to shine soon enough.
Well, I don't know if they have one. Do they have a gluten-free churro in San Jose?
They do not. And, man, those churros are good.
Yeah. We need to start that campaign here and now. Let's get a gluten-free churro for Ben, even if it's just one. Just so you can enjoy a churro while you're in San Jose. I feel like that's got to be an item for any California trip.
Oh, I do think so. And of course, you know, Sam, in referring to the San Jose churros, they are famous at that ballpark due to literally one man. Often when an item is famous at a ballpark, it's because it's, you know, has some tie into the region, and it's there's more of a commonality to it. Not to say that churros aren't eaten in, you know, California all the time, but the reason it's such a big deal in San Jose is Hippolito Super Churros Man Cerda, who is a vendor who has been selling them at the ballpark for decades now, and it's become iconic. So iconic that it inspired San Jose's Copa identity, the churros. And man, those churros look good. Last year when I was in Hudson Valley, you know, cider donuts night, but actually the individual who they pressed into commission to make the cider donuts was originally a churros guy. And I interviewed him at the end of the night, and he gave me some churros, and I was just looking at him and looking at him and looking at him. And finally, I was like, you know what? I'm going to have like a couple bites of this churro. And it was so good. And I didn't die. And whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So here I am, Ben's Biz, stronger than ever.
Well, don't, you know, suffer for your art, Ben. That's all I'll say. Like, I don't want to encourage you to eat something that your body's going to disagree with, just to report on this podcast and elsewhere about food.
That's true. But what great suffering leads to the best art. And so I'm willing to suffer for my art. I don't want to be some mediocre hack who's just floating by in a life of whimsy and wonder. I want to suffer, and that way my work will be better. So if it involves eating a churro to suffer and make better art, I'm willing to do it.
Okay. Well, those are the lengths. That's the Ben Hill promise on the road.
The Ben Hill guarantee.
Yeah. The lengths and distances you will travel for your art and for the betterment of minor league baseball are second to none. And, you know, I know you're prepping for that trip, but the minor league content wheel continues to spin. You and our favorite host of Ghosts of the Minors, Josh Jackson, collabed on a piece this week about the best minor league bobbleheads, which obviously is such a huge part of the promo calendar every year. Teams get incredibly creative with the types of bobbleheads they're handing out. You basically awarded your own favorite bobblehead or best bobblehead for every farm system. Some of the ones that kind of stood out to me, one is from the Astros system. It's a Babe Ruth bobblehead, which you might not think like Astros and Babe Ruth by any means. Not only is it a Babe Ruth bobblehead, it's Babe Ruth on a bicycle that's being handed out by Fayetteville, the single A affiliate of the Houston Astros, because apparently Babe Ruth hit his first professional home run there, and also he raced up and down the main street on a bicycle. So therefore, here's Babe Ruth on a bicycle. Doesn't exactly look happy to be on a bike, to be honest, in that bobblehead. It's kind of funny to me for many reasons. But anyway, that's one that stood out to me. There's a few others. Like, there's one with Luis Angel Acuña And his father, not his brother, it says Ronald Acuna, but it's Ronald Acuna Sr., who also played for the Binghamton Mets back in the day. Now it's the Binghamton Rumble Ponies, of course. But a lot of ways teams are getting creative. What were some of your favorite bobbleheads as you and Josh were putting these together?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned the Fayetteville Babe Ruth one, because that is one of my favorites. When I visited Fayetteville, you know, home of the Woodpeckers in 2019, I got a tip. I can't remember if it was from the team or a reader. That there is a sign in Fayetteville commemorating Babe Ruth's first professional home run in 1914, which he hit in Fayetteville. And I went out to that sign, and it's now the site. It's basically along the side of a road next to a big, like, Department of Transportation building. So I took some pictures of that sign and always liked that little bit of history. That's a weird sign. One, it says the distance that Babe Ruth's home run traveled in meters, which this is America. Hello? I don't know why it is measured in meters, but it is. And it also says, and I feel I like to use the word apocryphal, and this sounded a bit apocryphal to me. The sign also says that it was in Fayetteville where George Herman Ruth acquired the nickname Babe in Fayetteville. So I don't know if we can confirm that, but we have him in Fayetteville in 1914, hitting his first professional home run, allegedly getting the nickname Babe, hitting that home run measured in meters and not feet. And to top it all off, he liked to ride up and down the streets on a bicycle. Now we have a bobblehead of Babe Ruth on a bicycle. And I don't know how tall it is in the metric system, but I don't know. It's maybe like 10 centimeters or something like that. But it is definitely one of my favorites of this season. And other ones, well, you know, Josh isn't here to tell you himself, but I like this one as well. We had to include it, of course, in the Red Sox system. The Portland Sea Dogs, AA Eastern League Portland Sea Dogs, playing nearby to where Josh Jackson lives at his undisclosed location. They are giving away a Trash Monster bobblehead, and Trash Monster is a long-running ballpark character at Hadlock Field, home of the Sea Dogs. And with a name like that, that's what he is. It's a mascot that doubles as a trash can, like a big open mouth for your trash. And so who would not want a Trash Monster bobblehead? So that's definitely another one of my favorites. What else? I want to mention one more just because. Oh, well, here's one. I'll mention one more. The Reading Fightin' Phils are doing two of this type of bobblehead. One was on opening day when they gave away a Bryson Stott bobblehead with his walk-up song, with an audio clip playing his walk-up song. I'm sure for copyright issues, it's not an actual the same song, but it's like a little guitar riff playing the same song. And Bryson Stott's song is that A-OK that everyone at the ballpark in Philadelphia sings along to. It's going to be A-O-A-O-K. See, I can sing. I can sing really well. This is a very musical episode of the show before the show. But now they're going to give away an Alec Bohm walk-up bobblehead, and with his walk-up music, and that's going to be on August 13th in Reading. And Bohm's song is the Kanye West song Famous, but he utilizes a portion that samples Sister Nancy's Bam Bam. But the way Sister Nancy sings, it goes like, bum, 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 and it sounds like his last name, not like Bam, like Bum. And so there's going to be a bobblehead where there's going to be a little clip of music playing some approximation of bum, bum, bum. Dung, dung, ding, dung, bum, bum.
Bum, bum, beat 'em. Bum, yeah. Bum.
Yeah. Shout out to Sister Nancy, dance hall legend, who I was looking at the New York City free concert outdoor calendars, and she was on one of the shows this year. So if you want to see Sister Nancy playing Bam Bam, Bum Bum, it's somewhere.
I got to say, I listen to that song unironically on its own a lot. Like, that's on a few playlists of mine. It's just a good bopping around the neighborhood song.
It really is. Bop around.
The original. We can put Kanye West's song to the side there for a second, but like that original one is good. Like, maybe Alec Bohm might want to consider switching to the OG version. That's all I'm saying.
I was thinking that too. Like, if you're utilizing that Kanye West song, we do not need to get into a discussion about Kanye West and his genius and his problems. you know, he's a complicated character. But why not just go with the Sister Nancy song, because that's the portion he's utilizing anyway. So
yeah,
I agree.
One other one I'll throw out there real quick, because we don't actually have a picture of it in this story, which only heightens my interest of it. It's the John Goodman bobblehead that is coming to AA Springfield on August 24th. There is a picture in the story of John Goodman wearing a Springfield Cardinals hat. and posing with the mascot, who I assume is Springfield's version of Fred Bird. But
Louis
Bird. There you go. His cousin Louis. But I really want to see what a John Goodman bobblehead looks like. That sounds amazing. And he is a true baseball fan. He is a Cardinals fan. He's a Missouri native. He went to Missouri State. There's all sorts of connections here. But yeah, first 2,000 fans in attendance will get a John Goodman bobblehead on August 24th. And I want to see what the design looks like, because think of all the roles John Goodman has had. What one do you choose to use on a bobblehead? Maybe the greatest role of all is just being a Cardinals fan. Maybe they just go with that, but really excited to see that one.
Yeah, my guess is they don't really tie it into a pre-existing, you know, movie or TV show, and it'll just be John Goodman, the man, as a Springfield Cardinals fan. But I love that one as well, and I believe we talked about that bobblehead last month when I included it in a like a preseason promo roundup story. And yeah, we came to the conclusion that everyone loves John Goodman. He's just almost impossible to dislike, that guy, and a phenomenal actor. So that's definitely one of my favorites as well. So anyway, check out the full article to see one bobblehead from every major league organization, from a farm team within every major league organization. That's something Josh and I have been collaborating on a monthly basis. Those all organizational stories. They are, even though it's very light content, we do suffer for our putting those together. They are quite a beast to put together. But again, we are willing to be martyrs for the cause of good minor league material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my favorite parts about you guys putting together those stories, it just shows the tapestry of minor league baseball and, you know, what specific farm systems, where they are geographically, what those geographic areas prioritize and who they honor and what they promote and all that kind of jazz. So check that out. It's a great way of getting a snapshot of the minor league landscape as a whole. That story is on MLB.com and MILB.com. Search for best minor league bobbleheads for 2024. You can find it at either spot. Ben, our interview segment this week in terms of off the field stuff takes us just down the road from here, from you and I. You are in Manhattan, I'm in Brooklyn right now, but Jersey Shore, formerly the Lakewood Blue Claws, currently the Jersey Shore Blue Claws, have put together a song. And this harkens back to the time where we actually had a fully musical episode of the show before the show a few years back. Maybe minor league songs are back for 2024 and beyond, which would be a very exciting development. What can you tell us about the Jersey Shore Blue Claws song?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we love team themes, minor league team theme songs, and keep talking about how we need to do an updated version of the episode we did a number of years back that was entirely team theme songs, one of my favorites that we ever did. But now we're entering a new era of team theme songs, and we are going to talk about the Jersey Shore Blue Claws, brand new Shore Town is Your Town. And I don't need to go into it more than that, because you're going to learn all about it right now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
My co-host Sam Dykstra is currently wearing a Bruce Claus jersey, a Jersey Shore Blue Claus promotion celebrating Bruce Springsteen. But we are here to talk about another Jersey Shore Blue Claus musical endeavor, their new teen theme song, Shore Town is Your Town, sung by local elementary school students. And here to talk about that is Blue Claws VP of Communications and radio broadcaster Greg Jamborisi and Director of Promotions and Entertainment Gianna Fiacco.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, so Shore Town is Your Town, the new team theme song. Heard this was a long time in the making, or something where the seeds were planted years ago, but it's just coming to fruition now. If you could talk a little bit about the origin story of putting a team theme song together.
Yeah, take that one, Gianna.
Okay. So Greg and I were actually sitting in the production room. We were working an event that we would have yearly at the ballpark that just required us to sit up in the production room for for the full day. And I believe it was Greg's idea, but he was like, I really think that, you know, this land is your land, Shoretown is your town. I really think that we can do something here with this. And I was like, all right, let's just, you know, we're up here, we're sitting together. Let's just play around with it. And we wrote out a full, I think we wrote like a couple extra verses. We took it and ran with it. And then it sat in our Google Docs for probably like a year or two. And then this year we brought it back out and we were looking over it and we were like, you know, this was really good. Why didn't we ever do anything with this?
So we knew we were going to switch the name of the stadium to Shoretown Ballpark. We hadn't announced it yet, but it was going to happen in a couple of months. And Gianna and I were sitting there and like, what can we do with Shoretown? And we came up with that. So yeah, we put the whole thing to paper and I would say about 80% of what we had originally wrote is the final version. And, you know, we had to tweak a few different verses and a few lines here and there, but most of what we wrote was what we originally put down, you know, a couple of years ago. And then back in January or February, Gianna's in my office and we were looking for some file. This is really just random luck. We were looking for some file on my computer and I don't delete anything, so it's quite the search. And we stumbled across this, the sheet, and we're like, you know what? We got to bring this back out. So yeah, we played around with it and then had the idea of having some school kids record it. So we reached out to our ticket department and they had you know, a few schools that always come out and sing the anthem every year. They're like, yeah, let's just ask. And everybody was willing to do it. We shared it with our videographer, Taylor Petrangelo, who really did an unbelievable job with the whole video. We kind of had a little vision for it, but Gianna and I are in no position to execute that, but she nailed it. So, and she's like, yeah, I think we can do this. And she did it.
She exceeded all of our expectations. When we watched the video, me and Greg were both just like in awe of like, wow, this really came together even better than we were envisioning. So.
Yeah. And the kids, so this song is sung entirely by kids at yeah. four different local elementary schools. And that's really, you know, it could be an endearing ditty regardless, but really what makes it is the kids' vocalists and the fact that they have local connections to the community. I can't think of anything. Of course, I've heard a lot of minor league baseball team theme songs, but I can't think of any that were produced in this way. Did you have any, you know, precedent for this going forward, or, you know, how did it all come about in that manner in terms of switching it to not, you know, hiring a professional singer or a professional band, but doing it in this
You know, we just thought it'd be cute to have the kids do it. And that was pretty much the extent of it. Obviously, we could have had our staff do it, but it wouldn't have been nearly as cool. It would have been terrible, actually. So,
we also, in our creative process, you know, once we had written pretty much the whole song, we were like, all right, like, we feel good about this. Greg and I had our whole department and some of the sponsorship department come into Greg's office, and we printed out the lyrics and we played the background music and we made everybody sing it, because we figured if we are not able to sing it, we can't expect the children to be able to sing, you know, like if we're stumbling on certain words or if it doesn't fit right with the tune once we're doing it. So we actually made a group of us sing the song, and I can assure you the children did significantly better.
There are a couple lines. The one though is when the sun comes shining, the claws get going, pork leg and cheese race. Like, you got to be quick. Like, we probably have one extra syllable in there, but we got the kids to really nail it. But the kids, you know, I can't say enough about the kids. I remember, so the first school we went to was the Spruce Street Elementary School, and in the video they're the last verse, and they have it's the one with the little kid named Josias who does a little crab hop in the front at the end. So we filmed that on a Tuesday, and it was the first week of March, and on Friday I'm in Florida and I get a couple text messages from this number that I don't have, and I'm like, all right, I'll deal with this later. So I kind of forgot about it, and then two or three days later, I'm just going back and I'm like, oh, I have this. What was this? Pull it out. And it was the teacher, John Farnsworth, with the first graders from Spruce Street. And he had sent me videos from a couple of days before when they were practicing. And they were so good. And this was the practice. They were so into it. And as soon as he sent those to me, I showed Gianna. And we both said, like, hey, you know, this might actually, this might really work out. Like, we were optimistic, but we didn't really know, you know. But I think the kids were so good. And, you know, we would go to the different schools and they would ask, where's this going to go? Like, is it going to be on at the game? Like, when we come to the game, are we going to play it at the game? Of course, you know. And then a couple of them would always ask, like, is it going to be on Instagram? And I'm like, you're eight. Do you have Instagram? And like, oh yeah, we have. Okay. So yeah, it'll be on Instagram. So yeah, they were so excited. And that really made it for us, I think.
There's two things I want to touch on what you guys just said. First off, at some point, maybe several months down the line, maybe in the off-season doldrums, release the adult cut. Just so we all have a baseline of which to go. It doesn't have to be now. I don't want to undercut the kids, but I want to hear what the adult cut is just like. If anything, just to highlight how good the kids are. And two, I'm glad you brought up that the pork roll, egg and cheese race line, because that was one thing. I was listening to it first, and I was like, oh, man, they really sped through that and hit it. I imagine that was – but it's still my favorite line, I think, because it underlines – something that's at the ballpark and also just where you guys stand on the Taylor Ham versus pork roll debate, all that jazz. What are your favorite lines that you guys actually got into this piece? I know you said there are multiple verses that didn't make the cut, but out of the ones that did, what is your favorite?
Wow. I'll let Greg answer that one first, because that's a good question.
I like the mini golf course. It's it's my favorite part of the stadium. We added it in 2018. As I went walking around the ballpark, I saw before me a mini golf course. That's kind of cool. You know, one of the things that we tried to do was kind of just capture the stadium and the whole Jersey Shore aspect to in the song, and B, you know, kind of mirror what we have in the ballpark. And our owners did a great job when we put in the mini golf and the boardwalk games in 2018. And we wanted to make sure that, you know, some of that got a mention in the stadium to try to, you know, wanted to bring the Jersey Shore to the stadium, and B wanted to bring the stadium to the lyrics.
Yeah, for sure. I think I like the get those claws up part. I feel like that's something that we try to always encompass at the ballpark. We have, we have it on t-shirts. We encourage fans to, you know, do the like pinchy claws, like claws up. Our players do it, you know, when they do something great in the game. So I like that part, because I also, if you watch the video and you see the kids singing the song, they also get their claws up. So I just like that part a lot.
Yeah, and both of those things, I think, really fit the form of having kids sing the song. Like, if you were a kid walking into a ballpark, the first thing you're going to see is a mini golf course. That's just, you know, I have a 7-year-old nephew, 5-year-old niece, like, that's what they're going to see. I totally get that. And so it really fits that the kids are singing that and the get the claws up. I can imagine kids going to a game at, you know, Shoretown and just saying that for the rest of the weekend and annoying their parents in a good way, in a good way. But you know, how does it, you guys talked about this before of like, you guys were going to change the name to Shoretown. You guys have changed the name of the team in recent years from Lakewood to Jersey Shore. How is this kind of an extension of that process? You've already talked about bringing the Jersey Shore to the ballpark itself, but encompassing that whole culture of what it is to be Jersey Shore with the team. How is this the next step in that journey?
I think it was kind of a goal when we started it. And I guess we didn't really accomplish it. Was to help kind of do this for the unveiling of the stadium, or do something for the unveiling of the new stadium name, which was announced March 15th ish of 2022. So it's been a little while. So, but you know, Shoretown as a venue, more than a stadium, but like, you know, a town, like all, you know, there are so many beach towns as you go 40 miles of coastline from the northern part of Monmouth County to the southern part of Ocean County, which is where, you know, we draw from, that's our main territory. And, you know, that's a lot of town. There are a lot of towns in there and, you know, all different names, but we want to be one of, you know, we want to be one of those. And, you know, we're going to go to Point Pleasant. We're going to go to Seaside. We're going to go to Belmar. We're going to go to Spring Lake. We're going to go to Long Beach Island. We're going to go to Shoretown. And Shoretown is the name of, is the stadium, but it's also the, you know, the area, the, it's also the ballpark. It's also the venue, the kind of the experience. You know, when you say you go to, you're going to go to Seaside, you know, you're going to go to the boardwalk, you're going to go to the beach, you're going to do, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Well, we want that. When you say Shoretown, you're not just coming to the game, but you're coming to the venue that has, or the area or the zip code or whatever that has mini golf, boardwalk games, Blue Claws game, you know, live music and all this other good stuff, you know, a fun time with your family.
And you guys talked about how it was always the idea to have kids do this and sing the song. And again, I think that fits the form incredibly well. I'm going to say this while I'm wearing this shirt. There are a lot of, let's say, famous singers from New Jersey who, you know, could sing covers. Have you guys reached out to anybody or thought about like the next step in the, now you have the original out there. It's ripe for covers. Have you thought about involving anybody who could be local in doing the next version?
You know, I didn't, but I mean, now we're going to have to.
if you want somebody to help out in that request, I am available, Greg. That's all I'm saying.
All right. You got it. We'll do that. I think
I'll co-sign the email with you. How about that?
No problem. We'll have an adult. We need an adult version. We need a player's version.
Yeah, we did talk about that. We want to make a player's version.
We have a few players that I don't know if they can sing, but they can fake it enough where we can get through the song. Yeah. And then covers. Yeah. Actually, that's a good point. That's a good point. We were kicking around. This guy has gotten nowhere, but for our next song, we were kicking around something with "We Didn't Start the Fire," but that might be a bridge too far for now. We'll do that. Yeah, you're right. We got to figure out. We got to complete this circle first.
Well, now that the song's out there and in the world, you talked a little bit about this, but how do you see it being deployed, both, you know, online and in marketing campaigns and also at the ballpark itself? Do you have set spaces for it? Are you going to see how that evolves over time? Or, you know, what's the plan as you're starting out?
So we did have Josiah's school. What was that? Spruce Street Elementary?
Yep.
They had come to the ballpark already for their outing. So we did play an unfinished version of the song during pregame for the entire ballpark, and everybody loved it. The kids were so excited to see themselves on the video board, but even like season ticket holders and just everyone around the ballpark was like, could see them like bopping their heads and really getting into it. So when timing allows, I definitely plan to play it pregame for the entire ballpark every game. And then obviously when a school that has participated in the video comes out, you know, we'll highlight it a little further than that with like a PA read and kind of get it out there that like, hey, they're in attendance tonight and they are part of this song.
Once we get into the teeth of the summer, we will use we'll advertise on TV in the area, and we can't use the whole thing. It'll be too long, but there's definitely a way to chop up. Even if it's just like the Shoretown is made for you and me, like ending, we can definitely chop that up into the commercial, which I know we definitely plan on using that. So it'll be out there in the public space, from here on out. We have an old Blue Claws song called Blue Claws Rock, which is over 20 years old, and it was made by, as far as before my time here, and it was made by, I think, like a jingle company, or, you know, like you've seen those companies, right? They write, you know, you could write theme songs or jingles or whatever. I'm pretty sure it was made by them. It's not bad. If you listen to it, you definitely get the vibe that they were trying to imitate, like Springsteen and the E Street Band. There's like a lot of big saxophone sections. It's out a little outdated now. We can't use it anymore, but it exists. We do play it on our on hold music. So I think we're going to swap in this song on our on hold music as well. So that'll be good. And we'll use it in a bunch of different spots. Those are just a few.
Nice. And Gianna, you have a line in the press release for this song about how you need to find quality performers to sing this song, and you definitely could not find them on staff. If you had to find them on staff, though, you know, who would it be? Would it be the Greg? I mean, who would sing this song?
Mm-hmm. I think, well, from the front office staff, yeah, I would probably say Greg, actually, but I honestly, he's one of the few coworkers that I have actually heard sing. So maybe we could have some type of like audition. But I do have a couple people on my promotion staff that actually have really, really great voices as well. So maybe that's another version, the Claws Crew version.
They did a great take me out to the ball game on Fan Appreciation Day last year.
Nice. Well, there's a lot of directions you can go with this. I do hope to hear Greg's version of the tune at some point, and anything else you come up with.
That's what the world needs.
I would say so. But for now, we've got something better. We've got the kids. So we're going to play this song now on the Show Before the Show podcast. It's been a long time since we played a song, and it's good to feel like a radio DJ. So here is Shoretown Is Your Town, the new song for the Jersey Shore Blue Claws. And Greg and Gianna, thanks so much for joining us on the Show Before the Show podcast.
Thanks
guys.
Us.
Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We interrupt this podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Ghosts of the Miners. Miners, in which all of you out there in Radio Land must identify the legitimate historical ball club or player hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One once hurled deep into ball games. The others never even made it to the mound. In the last segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball players did at one time exist. A. Apples Drake. B. Bananas Cook. C. Peaches Nelson. I have a warm and fuzzy feeling about you if you picked C. Peaches Nelson, who had a fruitful 14-year career in the minors in the early 20th century. Sometimes confused with fellow left-handed pitcher Andy Nelson, who made two appearances with the White Sox in 1908, but who, contrary to one popular source, does not seem to have been nicknamed Peaches during his lifetime, Clarence Peaches Nelson was given the moniker early and heard it often. Born not in Georgia, but in Tennessee, Peaches Nelson started his pro career with Texas, hitting the road with the 1904 Houston Wanderers in the South Texas League. Nelson played all over Texas, Oklahoma, and the South across the next several years, Peaches indeed making it to Georgia with the 07 Augusta Taurus of the South Atlantic League, but was likely most beloved in Houston. Indeed, he'd been back in that burg with the Buffaloes in the Texas League of 08 before he was traded to the same circuit's Waco Navigators, shortly after which Peaches had a rotten outing against the Galveston Sand Crabs and was saluted in the Galveston Daily News with the following piece of verse, edited here for clarity. A lad there was in Houston. Nelson was his name. He was a baseball player, and pitching was his game. Nobody in enemy lineups could reach, and soon they came to call him the famous Fifth Ward Peach. When Peaches Nelson pitched a game, the Houston fans would roar. When they traded him to Waco, the Houston fans were sore. Though we've heard so much of Peaches, we hadn't seen him play until the classic at this ballpark yesterday. We saw the Peachy Peaches, four innings saw him stick, saw 10 base hits and 13 runs make Peaches mighty sick. Isn't the press the pits? The skin of Peaches was thick, though, and he showed no signs of fermenting ill will against newspapermen. In fact, it was to a newspaper he wrote in 1915, when having continued to pitch through the 14th season at age 32, and having settled more or less in the Midwest, where he first appeared in the 3i League in 1910, he was desperate to find a new line of work. Namely, Peaches Nelson wanted to get into umpiring. From Davenport, he wrote back to the Houston Post asking the sports editor to get the word out. It only sort of worked. The Post, after noting Peaches' intent to don the blue, wrote, "Any club desiring an experienced southpaw can find him in Nelson." It seems Nelson did umpire for several seasons straight, but he found himself back on the mound with the Sioux Falls Sioux in 1920, pitching with that club through the 22 season when he was 40 years old. And that's how Peaches Nelson had a juicy career. Now, on to the question for next time. Which of these noble teams tried to big league us all in the minors of yesteryear? A. The Detroit Dukes. B. The St. Louis Earls. C. The Cleveland Counts. Want to know the answer? Bow down. Or tune into the next Ghost of the Minors. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer, Ben Hill, is heading to the West Coast, and I've got to tell the Golden Staters to hide their silver.
Hey, I'm back to say goodbye via the magic of podcasting on this week's episode of the show. Before the show, before we get out of here, it's back to just me and Sam. It is time for this week's edition of Name That Dude, in which we try to guess a random major slash minor leaguer that just pops into our heads, and we send out the body of work and see if our cohorts can guess it. This is the first time I think that I'm asking and you're answering.
This is definitely the first time I think you've come up with that dude. So
I'm excited. Okay, name that dude. All right, Sam. This gentleman was drafted not once, but twice. First in the 17th round, the 2004 MLB June Amateur Draft by the Seattle Mariners. And then in 2007 by the Toronto Blue Jays. I'm not going to tell you when he was drafted. That might give it away. But anyway, He made his professional debut with the New York Penn League's Auburn Doubledays in 2007. In 2008, he jumped up to high A and double A at Dunedin and New Hampshire. 2009, remember when Las Vegas was the Blue Jays affiliate?
Yes.
The Jays affiliated 51s in 2009 and 2010. And then he made his big league debut on August 7th. Of 2010. He spent parts of six seasons in the big leagues, all with that Toronto club. Actually, no, I checked that. His first four were with that Toronto club. And then parts of the 2014 and 15 seasons with the Texas Rangers and the Tampa Bay Rays. He finished his professional career actually in the Rays and Phillies organizations in 2016. Spent some time at AAA Durham and AAA Lehigh Valley. I also discovered while looking him up that he is younger than me, which I did not expect. Your thoughts so far, or do you need like a little bit more of a hint?
I feel like I need a little bit more of a hint.
Position player. Go position player. Would you like his position?
I would like his position.
He is a catcher and played a little bit of first base in his career. Not a ton of first base, but a little bit of first base.
Greg Zahn?
No, that's a good guess.
I'm trying to think of like Blue Jays catchers. Yeah, he was probably older. Blue Jays catchers.
Let's see about who else would have been on. I mean, the biggest names obviously on those Blue Jays rosters back then were Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah.
Colby Rasmus. Remember when Colby Rasmus was around?
You said you can't give me when he was drafted?
Oh, I can give you when he was drafted.
Okay.
2007, and he was a first-round pick in 2007 as a catcher. He was...
From college.
From it college, seems like because he was first drafted by the Mariners in 04 out of high school. Did right. not sign.
And then he went to 07.
Went to college. I actually did not know this, but he went to college at the University of Tennessee. This is a tough one. I'm not going to... I'm sure there's one Blue Jays fan out there who's yelling.
Yeah, Blue Jays catchers from like the early 2000s or 2010s. Why is this blanking on me?
I'll give you a hint that may tip the scales for you.
Okay, please
do. His name, his first name, just initials.
What?
His first name, he just goes by initials. His name is blank, blank, blank.
Oh.
This is me every week as I navigate through the pathways of my brain to find, what was Jock Jones's name?
It's not J.P.R. and Sebia.
It is J.P.R. and Sebia. He did it. Sam Dykstra, everyone. He did it. He cannot be defeated. Sam Dykstra, our very own Sam C. Dykstra.
Why do I think of Aaron Sebia as like elsewhere? I think of him more as a Ranger for some reason.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know why that is.
He did play 63 games for the Rangers in 2014. Yeah. He played 48 that year for AAA Round Rock as well. J.P. Aaron Sebia. There's not a whole lot of just straight up initials guys, but I would like to be an initials guy. If I went by T.S. Mon, I think that'd be a lot more compelling, a lot more professional than Tyler. Kid born in 1985 was Tyler.
T.S., you would have to also obviously write poetry.
Oh, absolutely. Come on. That's the only, and I don't write poetry, so I don't know how well, that would work. But yeah, I would definitely have to do that. J.P. Aaron Sebia, nice job.
I mean, I thought about going, I remember pitching to my newspaper editor in college, like, what if I just wrote by S.C. Dykstra?
Yeah, S.C. Dykstra is awesome.
Absolutely not. He shot it down. And I was like, come on. He's just like, no, you're lame. Trying to sound like you're 45 years old and you are not. You just need to be 20. Just
if
be
you're
20.
If you're going to be S.C. Dykstra, though, you can't. You can only write like think pieces, like opinion columns. You can't write like, here's S.C. Dykstra just like covering this men's hockey game. Like you got to write. You got to be deep. You got to be like on the opinion page only.
Well, no, it's just all my words would have so much more weight.
In case you're wondering, by the way, Jonathan Paul, Aaron Sebia. Jonathan Paul. Also a member of the U.S. team for the World Baseball Classic in, I believe, 2013. I think he was on that 13 squad.
There you go.
And now you know the rest of the story. All right. Well, that's going to do it. We're going to say goodbye for this week. Next week, Bruce Springsteen joins the show. I'll be traveling again, but it'll be a little bit more normal.
So. I assume you're getting Bruce from Mexico.
Right, right. Bruce is going to be down there. And then I'm going to be in the Philly area the following week, next week. So we might just hang out at Bruce's. I assume he lives on the Jersey Shore somewhere. Right. So his whole personality is based around. I'm assuming he lives there.
He does live in Jersey. I don't think it's on the shore, but I'm not liberty to discuss exactly where he lives.
You can't give away the party locations where you've been hanging out with Bruce.
Yeah, no, of course
not. Obviously. All right. Well, for the top pitching prospect in baseball, Paul Skeens, huge thanks to him for joining us. To Josh Jackson for Ghost of the Miners, Benjamin Hill, and Sam Dykstra, SC Dykstra to you. My name is Tyler Mon. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the show. Before the show, we'll catch you next week.